Souvenirs.
Not from
Oxford. Yes. By Lisa Whistlecroft. Our guest today on Calvos and Damien in the House. And no questions about the piece, unless there's something more you wanted to say about it.
I don't think there's anything I want to say about it.
Okay. I noticed that some of your resume also includes studies and concerns about women in electroacoustic music. This is an item that comes up for discussion a lot in the various news groups and listservs. And since you seem to have a strength in that area, let's hear from you about that and how things may have changed since 2000 when you did that last piece of research.
I think things have inevitably got better numerically. I mean, the numbers of women composers in all genres is low. It's not as low as the history books would like us all to believe, but it is low. I think I'm probably not particularly well loved by
people from Uxbridge.
People from Uxbridge, and from people who think I should possibly bang the women in music drum a little louder than I do. People often say, you know, well, you're a woman composer, and I always feel slightly uncomfortable that the idea of being a woman composer is different from being a composer. And actually, I rather like the things that Laurie Spiegel has had to say about that particular issue, because she doesn't even particularly like the term a composer. She thinks in terms of people who compose, and that for me makes much more sense than labelling people as a composer, as if that's somehow different from being, you know, a person.
Laurie was a guest on our show a couple of years ago, and we've listened to her stuff since the beginning, and find that her whole approach is so personable and so, in many ways, not even a political approach, at least within the music.
I don't think talking about women's music is helpful, and I feel rather guilty about that article about women in music technology, because I do still get people getting in touch saying, you know, you've done this research, and it wasn't research in any kind of a rigorous sense. I mean, it was a sort of lick a finger and stick it in the wind and see which way the wind was blowing kind of research. And I think there's a misconception, I think, that because there are very few women composers and because there are very few women into high technology things, that these two add together and make it an even smaller number of women who will be in music technology or in electroacoustic composition. And actually, I don't think the numbers are that much lower. I don't think that the two add up in quite that way. I think, in a way, it's more the fact that for a long time women were a rare breed in academia. Actually, getting a tenured post in a university was quite an achievement for a woman, because of whatever it is that kept women out of higher education, and I don't think, you know, I don't think we've got enough days to talk about that. And I think that was more of the problem, that actually women were a rare thing in universities. And that's getting better. But I'm a huge optimist, and I say that's getting better, and sometimes people say, well, it's not getting better as fast as it should.
The people in music a generation younger than us, and maybe two generations younger than us, are seem to be much more gender undefined in that technology way. It's like, you know, I can listen to a piece of music and have no clue based on sheer numbers whether I'm going to listen to a male or female composer. At least from the younger composers. Now, maybe you've noticed something different, but just from our perspective at Calvos and Damien, we get tons of recordings, and these days they're much more equally divided among the younger composers.
Although that's great.
We must say that we can always distinguish a composer from Uxbridge.
You can. It's all those news that they put in their music, isn't it?
Right, it's so unlike those from, say, Islington.
Yeah.
Yes, there are too many Rams.
Oh, exactly. Yes, yes, indeed.
I think one thing that is certain is that, you know, that the idea that you can tell that it was written by a woman is is complete nonsense. I don't think there is recognisably women's music in the sense that women write different music from the kind of music that men write.
Well, that's an interesting approach, because we've asked that question numerous times, and generally the response is you can't tell, but a few folks have said the concerns of the composers are different, and so although the music itself may not be sort of revealing of the background of the composer, the choices are.
Yes, I think that one has a lot more mileage in it. I think it is quite interesting to look at the sort of topics that when people choose, and to see if those are different, and the kinds of usage that they want the music to be put to, and I think the things that women say about their music. I think you can often tell program notes. You can tell the sex of the writer of the program notes more easily than you can tell the sex of the writer of the music. And I think it's quite interesting looking at sleeve notes, even on old, you know, 1960s recordings, looking at what people say about their music. And I think this is, you know, please don't be offended, but I think women are more often interested in talking about the music and its context, and men do sometimes seem to be more interested in promoting their career and perhaps in talking about the technology that they developed it in, and less about the music. So I find women's program notes more interesting than men's usually.
And also those incidents about menses are always so educational.
What? Oh, totally left me in the dust
exactly.
On that one.
Exactly.
What witch?
Yes.
What?
Do they have them in Uxbridge?
I'll have to get back to you on that. I'm not positive.
Start doing that acronym.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, back to the, you know, how you can tell those differences from the program notes. I think that's really interesting. I think there's a difference in title sometimes, but not so much. But the concerns about technology, now that's interesting, because I gave a talk at Hart College a couple of months ago, and they were asking me about the technology, and my immediate reaction was, I don't really care about that. That's not the message of my music. And they seemed surprised by that. Is your experience that the technology is really a strong component that students expect, or is that really kind of what you said about male and female composers having a different way of talking about their music?
I think if what I've just said were generalized to the point where you've just generalized it, I would probably start disowning it. I mean, lots and lots of people write program notes of both sorts. Most of my composer friends are men, and most of them never mention the technology in their program notes. I suppose to a certain extent, possibly going back to the problem of how much of this kind of music is tied into academic systems, that sometimes, particularly students, can't really separate out something that is there to inform and entertain and help their audience listen to something, and something which is going to be handed in at the end of the term or might be on their next CV, on their next resume for a job. And I think people use program notes to do all of those things, particularly at conferences. You know, sometimes people's program notes are what they developed the piece on, and their CVs are just a list of the prizes they've won. Because really deep down the CV is saying, I'm horribly in debt, and I only really need a job, and I'm really good, and here's the data to prove it.
Well, we are, but we're not in academia, so we don't see these things.
Whereas
and
I guess
this is always
because I'm an
always
amateur.
Revealing for us.
Because I'm an amateur, because I don't have to earn my living doing this. I can say what I like about my music. I don't have to get a job doing it because, you know, I have a job doing something different.
You mentioned about being in debt, but as you recall, when you were speaking at Hart, and as I was earlier, the students were quite interested in not the technology, but how to make a living producing music.
You have new...
What were you doing?
I pressed the wrong button, sorry.
I was trying to cue, and I thought I had the volume down. See, and I didn't.
Is that something that your students are, press you upon? Well, it's all right, nice to write the music, but we need to be able to make a living at it.
Well, I don't teach composition, So that's not an issue that I ever have to deal with. When I was teaching, I was teaching generalist music students who were doing a degree. Composition would be part of it, but I would imagine not a large number of them were going to go on and try and make a living as composers anyway.
Good move.
Yeah.
Let's listen to The Day Before, a short piece, a little different.
That's your
give
cue.
Give us an introduction.
Sorry, I thought that was the cue for you starting.
Oh, no.
This was an anti-war protest song. I mean, I wouldn't want to describe this as a piece of art music. If anything I've done is art music, this one probably isn't. I'm on the CEC mailing list.
That's the Canadian Electroacoustic Community,
which actually has people on, you know, from all over the world, and it's a very busy mailing list. And in the build-up to the war in Iraq, there was a lot of talk about, you know, what could artists do? Wasn't it all pathetic that all we could do is make music when other people were out on the streets protesting? And there was a kind of general angst about the whole thing. And Adrian Moore, who's at the University of Sheffield, said, well, maybe all we can do is write music, but we could do that and we could have a concert. And he said, you know, if people wanted to write pieces about the build-up to the war, he would program a concert of them. And I usually need something to set me off to write something, and I thought, I'm going to try and do that.
All right, here we go. Let's hear it. Lisa Whistlecroft's our guest. Here it is, The Day Before.
You have new mail.
Joe Wilding from Baghdad.
Joe Wilding.
As if it was the city of Baghdad that was the problem.
As if the problem.
As if it wasn't the idea that you can support and fund and arm someone who you know misses his political opponents and destroys whole towns of people, and that's okay because he's buying your weapons and selling you oil and starting wars with your enemies, with your help,
with your enemies,
not knowing you're helping the other side as well, covertly.
The other side with your enemies. With your help.
As if it wasn't the idea that once that person is outside of your control, you can besiege the people of the entire country, denying them adequate food, even despite a distribution system second to none. And after 12.5 years of suffering and death,
12.5 years.
Because it didn't work, you can flatten their country, shock and dwarf them into surrendering with cruise missiles.
Denying them adequate food, didn't work.
You can flatten their country. Jeremy phoned and said the bombers were on their way.
It's denied.
Some people didn't believe it would be denied. The 48-hour deadline ends at 4 a.m. Ahmed came and knocked on the door of our apartment and told us the same thing, the bombers are coming for us. He told me he was sorry. He shook my hand, held my shoulder and told me he was sorry. A siren sounded and my heart flipped, but then followed the familiar horn sound of a Red Crescent ambulance. Going where, I wondered. What accident, what illness, could possibly befall you in the hour before the war?
The 48-hour deadline ends at 4 a.m.
It's 3:30 a.m.
You have no more mail.
The Day Before by Lisa Whistlecroft, our guest today on Calvis and Damien.
In the house.
Do you practice that?
Practice what?
What? The queuing up the pieces in the wrong time? At the wrong time?
No,
sure.
No, the synchronized in the house.
Oh, no, we never practice synchronizing anything because we've done it for too long. Let's go into the Stella Obscura right away. Now, that's sort of funny language there. Palimpsest Stella Obscura. Tell what it means, a little bit about the piece. We'll listen to it, and also about the funniness of the choice of title.
Well, the funniness of the choice of title is because the piece has a strange history. I was a singer in the sense of I was a singing student when I was a music student and continued to sing in choirs and continued to have private lessons, and I was never very good, but I got a huge amount of pleasure from it.
What kind of things did you sing? Were we talking about a classical singer or
classical,
a pop singer?
Always classical, early music or fairly, you know, I used to say pre-Bach and post-Beethoven, some choice, post, oh dear, forget that, pre-Bach and post-Britain is what I used to say. I've got a very light early music kind of voice or...
A little John Dowland there?
Yeah, that kind of thing. No, I'm not going to sing on the show.
Come on.
Anyway, a friend...
We can sing it together.
No. A friend of mine, who is also a singing student, we were both involved in a concert. And it was just a concert for all of the students of our teacher. And she said to me she would like a recording of her singing, and I quite fancied a recording of the thing I was doing. So we set up a tape recorder in the balcony of the recital room, and I copied her song off onto a cassette tape and gave it to her. And she listened to it once and said, "Oh my God, I never want to hear that again. And nobody is ever going to hear that tape." And she worked in a departmental office, so she decided that the easiest way to erase the tape was to stick it into a tape recorder, put the tape recorder on to record, and then just get on with the day job. And so her little cheap cassette recorder set on record with its automatic gain control set to maximum sat there and erased the tape. And having erased it, she just took it out of the tape recorder and gave it me back and said, "You know, here's your tape, and it's all right, it's empty." And I slung it in a drawer and forgot about it. And sometime later I took it out of the drawer, found this tape with no label on either side, stuck it in the tape player, and thought, "This is amazing." And sometime after that, there was another call. I mean, I almost always respond to people calling for pieces. Somebody did a call for pieces about silence. And I thought, well, here's this recording of somebody who was trying to record silence and not managing to record silence. And I did some editing and some tidying up, but otherwise it's as it was on the tape. The title, palimpsest, is a posh word for something that's been written over something else. So the tape was itself a palimpsest because this recording was on top of the original song. My friend's name is Stella, and Stella Obscura means dark star or hidden star, which of course she was because she tried to hide herself under this recording. And she's in fact on the recording because she's making all the sounds that are on it.
Excellent. Let's hear it. Our guest is Lisa Whistlecroft, and this is Palimpsest Stella Obscura. Thank you.
Me speaking. Hello. Yes. Yes, of course. Are you coming tomorrow night? You can bring me tomorrow night if that'd be easier. That'd be fine. That'd be lovely. See you tomorrow. Bye.
palimpsest, Stella Obscura by Lisa Whistlecroft. Let's keep moving along with the questions. You also sent along to us a video, which, of course, we can't play on Calvis and Damien.
Why can't we?
Well, because,
it's
a radio show. We could watch it, but it wouldn't be very entertaining for the audience.
So that's their problem.
What's it like to write for dance? Did you write for dance, or was that just danced to?
No, it was done very collaboratively, she says, and then she's going to say immediately afterwards, actually, I wrote all of the sound after the choreography had been written, so you're going to say why, aren't you?
Yeah, I am.
Why?
We are both going
you're
to
both
say
going
why.
To say why.
Because we've both written for dance, and so we can just cross our arms here and say, all right, why? Lisa?
The choreographer and dancer approached me and said, would I be interested in working with them to make a dance piece? And the idea was, their idea was, that we would all work together and create something in a 10-day residency in a dance studio in London, not in Uxbridge.
Oh, I was thinking.
And they'd never worked with somebody like myself who works entirely in the studio and works onto fixed media. They had worked, the dancer had worked with an improvising musician who did use technology. But they hadn't realised that I work very much, you know, not in real time, spending a long time processing a sound and putting it together in the studio. But we all ended up in London for 10 days, and they worked on the choreography with me taking part in watching them and talking to them about what they were doing, but not actually making the sound. And at the end of the 10 days, they filmed what they had made, which was a complete dance work. And poor souls, they'd never had to work without any sound before. They would occasionally say, can't you just make some sound? And I said, well, yes, but that's not going to be helpful, is it? And they recorded the choreography at the end of the period, and then I came back home and wrote the music for it. So in that sense, the music was written specifically for the dance, for the choreography. But it was also written using all of the same materials that they'd been using. We worked for the 10 days on the first chapter of The Waves by Virginia Woolf. And the choreography is all drawn from ideas and movements and phrases and concepts and descriptions that are in that chapter of the book. And we'd agreed what kind of sounds would accompany the various characters in the dance, and then I built the score afterwards. So having made their choreography without any sound, they then got the whole score virtually just before the first performance, and
just before
the trust that nice. they had in me. I mean, I've no idea how badly they were panicking at the point where, you know, 10 days before the premiere, they still hadn't heard a squeak out of me. But
Damien has some stories about his dance work.
That was a
lot of panic, mostly on your part.
Yes, but I was thinking more in terms of Merce Cunningham and John Cage, who would come together at the very end without either having heard one of the others, and they were just, because it was very much a chance production, and the Merce Cunningham dancers would not have any idea what the music would be until the performance.
Mm.
And this is what you've done, sort of.
They had a little bit of time, but not very much. But at least it was written very specifically for the dance movements, so it did at least all fit together, just about in time.
Now, do we have a separate soundtrack for that or not? Did you compose that as a separate, more compact piece?
It doesn't work as a concert piece.
Yeah.
I've tried it, and you sit there thinking, so what the heck's going on right now? I mean, why is it doing that? So I have actually, you know, I've got it on CD because that's how we've performed it when we've performed it. You know, it has only been done live. It's not a video piece. It is a live piece. So the soundtrack is on CD. And we produced the DVD, the video of it, really in order for people to see how it looked, and so that the dancer and choreographer could send it off to people who might program it, because obviously they couldn't send the real thing. They had to send a recording of it.
What, you don't have a traveling troupe of dancers to just go off and say, yes, here's what we do?
A traveling troupe of dancer in this
case. A traveling
case.
Troupe of dancer who actually needs to make a living.
Oh, never that. Well, let's move on to GFAAW Silent Key. What's all that about, all those letters and more acronyms?
Yes, must be part of her degree.
No, it's not an acronym. The piece is about the airship, the R101 airship, which was built in Bedford, which is probably somewhere near Uxbridge.
It is, yes, very much so.
In 1930, and it was going to be, the whole airship thing was going to be the way of the luxury means of transport of the future, and of course the airship program, both in the UK and in the States, came to a very sudden end because of the disasters of both the R101 and Hindenburg. And you know, when they do catch fire, they catch fire in a very terrible way. The R101 only managed to fly for 7.5 hours before it came down in France and was burned completely away. And an artist by the name of Zoe Irvin, who's based in this country, had an exhibition and an installation in the art gallery in Bedford. And she'd spent a month interviewing people and talking to people in the community about the R101, because it's not so long ago that there aren't people still living who'd known the airship works being there. So she interviewed lots of people for whom this was part of their life, not just part of their history. And she also put on a radio broadcast that lasted 7.75 hours, which was the length of this one and only fatal flight of the airship itself. And it was a mixture of commissioned pieces, documentaries, spoken word documentaries, and also dance music from the time, music from Jack Hilton's dance band. And it was a long collage programme of all kinds of things. And she commissioned some works and invited some works for that radio show. GFAAW are the letters that were printed in huge letters on the side of the airship, and they were its call sign. They were the letters that it put in front of all of its radio communications so that people knew that was what it was. So that was the, you know, that's where the title comes from. It was the call sign of the fated ship.
And what got your interest aroused in this?
It was a strange combination of things. The call came out at a time when I was going through quite a lot of emotional things. My father had very recently died, and that was you know, a very emotional time for me. The call talked about several things. It talked about the airship hangars at RAF Cardington in Bedford, where my father in fact had worked briefly. It was about the radio transmissions between the airship and its base, and in fact my father was a radio operator during the war, so I was familiar with radio communications, I was familiar with Morse code and things like that. And the stories that Zoe wanted people to consider working into anything they did were to do with the communications of the ship. And also there'd been a really rather bizarre occurrence after the disaster. A psychic medium had given a seance, which they'd sort of billed that it was going to be an interview with a famous dead novelist. It had been, you know, it was all planned. And on the day, she delivered a message from the dead captain of the airship detailing all the things that were wrong with the airship and what had caused the crash. And at the time, it caused an absolute, you know, kind of news media storm, because it was all very iffy and exciting, and there seemed to be no way that it could be anything other than genuine, because how could this rather strange psychic medium know all this terribly technical stuff? And so there was that aspect in it as well. And what I did in my piece was all of the things that were real and true, like the real broadcasts from the ship, are in my piece in their original Morse code. Not the transmission from the ship, but keyed in by a friend of mine who is still a radio operator. And all of the stuff that the medium said is spoken in intelligible words. So I've kind of turned it inside out, that the true stuff is in code, and this all rather iffy stuff from the seance is in understandable English.
Fantastic. It's a great piece. Let's listen to it. This is GFAAW Silent Key by our guest today, Lisa Whistlecroft.
Engines too heavy, useful lift too small, elevated jam, oil pipe plug, flying too large, cruiser never could. Disposal lift could not be used, load too great for long flight. Cruising speed bad and ship bad, severe tension on the fabric which is changing. Never reached cruising altitude, water locked and ship's nose, weather bad for long flight. Too heavy, too much overweighted for the capacity of engine. No one knew the ship properly.
saying with special reference to wind and cloud.
Powerful piece, GFAAW Silent Key, by our guest today on Calvis and Damien
in the house,
Lisa Whistlecroft.
I wondered if it was called Silent Key because it's not in the key of, say, G flat minor, but it's some silent key.
No, it isn't.
It's the Morse code key.
It is indeed.
Or it's the key to the house in Uxbridge.
No, it's the Morse code key.
Ah,
which, of course, was silent after the death of its operator.
I've got one of them inside. Do you still have yours?
I may. I haven't looked for it for a long time.
I've long forgotten all the Morse code. You know, and there's an extended version, too, which has additional characters now, including the at sign for email addresses.
Oh, we must put this up in the link to
you're
it
not
from
telling
this interview.
People transmit their email messages by Morse.
Well, they can do it now. Not that they have this. I don't remember the code for it, but I was looking it up. You know, I'm doing an extensive prep for this show, of course. Looking up Morse code and discovering all these, you know, accented characters are now available and strange things that that were never included before. Mm. So anyway, back to you.
Oh, that, yes, right.
We've got two more pieces to hear, maybe three. Are we going to hear the long piece? Are you going to send that along?
If you want to, yes, it'll send everybody to sleep at the end.
Well, that's good. Absolutely. Let's talk about the almost nothing but parentheses, butterflies and clouds, end parentheses.
Mm-hmm.
Now we're getting into your modern era. Now we're getting closer to the present.
Well, you didn't have to kind of dig these out from the archaeological dust.
Well, it's so dusty here anyway that it doesn't matter. We've already had to take care of that, get rid of the dust on all this. Oh, we've been saying your name wrong this time. Oh, all right.
The archaeological dust bit?
Yes.
Back to the piece, though, the piece that was not written in Uxbridge.
No, it was written in Yorkshire.
And?
I had...
Don't leave it hanging like that.
I spent 5 days at a music summer school, which was held at Doncaster College in Yorkshire, as part of an organisation called COMA, the Contemporary Music Making for Amateurs, which is an amazing organisation. Actually, it's about the writing and performing of contemporary music, but written for and performed by amateur musicians. So.
Did she say comma or coma?
Coma.
Coma.
Yeah, well, there is also that.
Yes.
Everyone's kind of slightly comatose after the hours in the bar at the end of the hours of rehearsal. Yeah. And I'd gone because there was going to be an electroacoustic strand to the summer school. And I went with high intentions of recording lots of sound and processing it in their rather fine studios and making an abstract piece. And I slaved away and recorded lots of sound and processed lots of sound, and it got worse and worse and worse. And, you know, here was me giving up a week's holiday and a course fee to come and make a piece. And I got more and more despairing. And also, it's a beautiful campus, a beautiful old mansion house that's been converted to be the college buildings, and beautiful countryside around it. And several of us had thought this would be a wonderfully rich sonic environment to go and make recording. And there was nothing. It was grey, drizzly weather, and outside there was no interesting sound to record at all. And several of us are saying, where's all the nice sounds? What is there to do? What is there to record? And towards the end of the time there, there was a really heavy rainfall in the night, and as so often the way after that, the next morning was absolutely glorious. And the sun was shining, and it was July, and the flowers, you know, all looked nice and cleanly washed, and all the butterflies in creation seemed to come out from wherever it was they were hiding and start flitting around. But there still didn't seem to be any sound. And in despair over my studio piece, what I do when I run out of ideas in the studio sometimes is just go out and record things. And I said, I'm just going to go out and record things. I know there's nothing out there to record except butterflies and clouds, and they don't make any sound, but I'll go out and record the butterflies and the clouds. And, of course, this was on a campus with a music summer school going on. So I walked around the campus and recorded the things that I could hear and made a piece out of them.
Here it is, Almost Nothing But Butterflies and Clouds by Lisa Whistlecroft.
Thank you.
almost nothing but butterflies and clouds.
Crowds,
but,
no.
And clowns.
Oh, clowns.
And I heard her say butterflies and clowns at first, and I thought, why would there be clowns on campus? But then,
but of course,
there are teachers.
Yeah.
So that takes care of that question. Almost nothing but butterflies and clouds by Lisa Whistlecroft. Which brings the question forward.
Another one.
Why do you seem to work almost exclusively with found material or a natural sound?
Oh.
Or is that only what you've sent
to
us? Is there other stuff?
No, I don't think I've ever synthesized anything. I'm just fascinated by all the sounds that are there. I've always been fascinated by sound. I love conventional music, I love notated music, I love the nature of musical instruments, but that was always, you know, running in parallel with me for this fascination with just what was going on around me. And it wasn't until I discovered that people did make music out of those kind of sounds that I started to think, well, maybe I can do this too. And for me, it's just so much more rewarding to take a sound and play with it, see what it can do, see what it turns into. And yes, I use loads and loads of computer software to process it. But I think if I start with something that is intrinsically interesting, I can explore it. Whereas if I start with nothing, I'd have to make it, and that's kind of scary. That's like being given a blank piece of paper and being expected to make something. And I think, you
so
know, I've always said, you know, I'm not a creative person in that way. If you give me a blank sheet of paper and a pencil and leave me there for a week and come back, I'll give you back a blank sheet of paper and a pencil and a very hungry look.
or a gun. Hmm.
You need a didgeridoo in your life.
I do?
That must be it.
Yes. Quite.
Can I eat it?
Okay. Yes.
Mm. There it is.
Yes. Oh, but
did she sample
it? I gather that they are a man's instrument, and it's.
Oh no!
Are they?
It's not. It's time to change
it's
that.
It's not. It's not appropriate for women to play them.
Well, it would if it had a nice little antimacassars around it.
No, no. Seriously, I was reading recently that there is actually a problem. In as far as traditionally it was a man's instrument, and there are indigenous instruments from indigenous people which were allocated, you know, to women, and men weren't allowed to play them. And I believe in Australia at the moment there is negotiation going on about whether it is offensive to teach girls to play the didgeridoo. But, no, I haven't got one, and I'm not sure that I would know how to play one. I have a feeling they're like brass instruments, and I've never managed to get a sound out of a brass instrument. I don't think I can...
All the better.
I don't think I can make the right kind of raspberry noises to start the process off.
Well, you know, it's interesting you said about collecting the sounds. I guess they have a context already. When you're recording them, and they're associated with the time, the place, the experience of doing it, and so they kind of reveal themselves first, and then you help them reveal themselves more.
Yes, and I think they can be transformed into something that then creates a context they didn't have before. One of the things that I did find fascinating, I've played souvenirs to quite a lot of people who are new to this kind of music. And they hear things in souvenirs that I didn't know were there. That many people who listen to it say, I really like the bit in the rainstorm. And they can hear a rainstorm in that piece that I didn't put in. Now, I did deliberately transform some sounds to sound like the sea. The sea I did try and put into that piece. But the rainstorm, other people have found it in there. I didn't put it there. It just happened. And I think that's one of the wonderful things about natural sound, is that not only can you explore what's in them, but sometimes they create things that you didn't know was in them.
Which brings us to Death Among the Apple Trees. give us some context about that. We have a half bushel of apples. Oh, I can say bushel, can't I? Because it's an imperial measure. Isn't
yeah,
it?
We don't use it anymore. But a half bushel of apples sounds good because that's quite a big bagful, isn't it?
Yes. A fellow came by yesterday to sell us some mustard pickles, some buttercup squash, and some apples.
Mm.
And so I was thinking about those, that wonderful pile of apples, and I thought, death among the apple trees. What could that mean?
Hmm. Sounds ominous.
It's a quote from the Virginia Woolf that the dance piece was made about. The piece is actually a 3-minute extract from the dance piece. It was about the only 3-minute extract that worked well completely on its own as a concert piece. And it's the part of the dance relating to a character called Neville, who is one of the 6 characters in the novel and in the dance piece. He had an obsession with knives and with regularity and with timekeeping, and those things are made plain in his music. But the opening bit of his section is based on a part of the narrative where he's describing the fact that he overheard the cook describing how a man had been found with his throat cut. And near the beginning of the piece there is a fairly easily connected sound that relates to that. And in the novel he muses on the circumstances of where he was when he heard that. And the bit in the narrative there is about how if you hear something, it's like the everybody knows where they were when JFK was shot. You know, it's the sort of if you hear something terribly shocking, you always remember what you were doing and where. And he says, I will call this moment death among the apple trees forever. And I just picked that little phrase as being the essence of this piece that was extracted from the dance.
Let's hear it. Short piece by Lisa Whistlecroft. This is Death Among the Apple Trees.